WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Ah! Hey! Tell me what you're gonna do about that. Tell me what you're gonna do. I got to know about that. Did you love for real? Do you know how I feel? Tell me what you're gonna do. Yeah, about that. I got ants in my pants and I need to dance. Come on. Got ants in my pants and I need to dance. So big fine mama, come give me a chance.
James Brown celebrates his birthday on Sunday. According to Brown, he's turning 65, but some experts say he's turning 70. Either way, it's a good reason for us to celebrate his music on this archive edition of Fresh Air. We'll start with an interview about his life with Bruce Tucker, who co-authored James Brown's autobiography. Tucker is a white writer who was teaching a course at Fisk University on the autobiographies of black musicians when he realized there was a big gap. James Brown had not written his story. Tucker convinced Brown to write the autobiography, The Godfather of Soul, and became Brown's collaborator. I spoke with Tucker in 1990 after a new edition of the book was published. It was first published in 1986, the year that Brown recorded Living in America. You describe James Brown as the most important living American musician. Let me ask you to describe what makes him that important.
Well, I think unquestionably he's the most influential. James Brown's music is everywhere now in the landscape of contemporary music. It underlies rap, dance pop, jazz, funk, African world beat. There's hardly a popular musician who hasn't been influenced by James Brown. And of course, he's heard most clearly in rap, where his songs and his voice and so forth are either sampled over and over again, or he's explicitly mentioned as the source of inspiration. And the music for which he should be known is the funk. He's called the Godfather of Soul, which is slightly misleading because his enduring contribution to American music is funk, the records he made in the mid-60s through the early 70s.
Well, let's listen to the first hit that he had, and this is from 1956. The record was Please, Please, Please. Would you like to say something about this?
Well, this is James's first record. He recorded a demo of it in a Macon radio station, and it eventually got to King Records in Cincinnati, and he went up there, and the Famous Flames went with him, and they cut it, and it was a hit. It was a big hit.
Please, 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 please. Well, you done me wrong.
James Brown, Please, 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 recorded in 1956, and my guest Bruce Tucker wrote James Brown's autobiography with him. James Brown actually started to sing in jail, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Actually, he had done a few amateur shows and things like that before he was sent to jail. That is, the first time, when he was 15 years old. And when he emerged from jail 3 years later, he formed a gospel group, which eventually evolved into an R&B group and became the Famous Flames.
Fill us in a little bit about his background. He came from a really poor background.
Yes, he was born out in the woods in South Carolina and moved into Augusta, Georgia, which was a wide-open serviceman's town at that time in the late 30s, early 40s. Lived in a brothel with an aunt named Honey Washington. They sold moonshine whiskey in addition to the other activities that went on in that house. Eventually, the house was closed down by the police. James then, as a pre-teenager, I guess you would say, began getting into trouble here and there. He broke into some unlocked cars to steal some clothes, got caught, and was sentenced to 8 to 16 years in prison for breaking into unlocked cars. Again, another extremely harsh sentence. He served only 3 of those years. He wrote a letter to the parole board saying that he wanted to get out and sing gospel for the Lord. He was known as Music Box in prison because of his singing. He got out, formed the group, and then about 6 years later, there came Please, 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 and then after that, he conquered the Apollo Theater in New York and went on from there to become the superstar that he remains.
Well, you mentioned the Apollo Theater. Why don't we listen to something from his 1962 Live at the Apollo album? And James Brown, I mean, has been a spectacular performer, and this will give some sense of the more like show business aspect.
Well,
of his performances.
Yes, and the excitement of him as a live performer in front of the toughest audience in the world, the Apollo Theater audience.
And what we're hearing is James Brown getting introduced.
Yes.
So now, listen, gentlemen, it is start time. Are you ready for start time? Thank you, and thank you very kindly. It is indeed a great pleasure to present to you at this particular time, national and international known as the hardest working man in show business, man that's saying, I'll go crazy, bewildered, $1 million seller, lost someone, the very latest release, Night Train. Let's everybody shout and shimmy. Mr. Dynamite, the amazing Mr. Please Please himself, the star of the show, James Brown and the Famous Flames.
Well, I don't really want to say anything after that.
Not much to say.
No. Did he ever travel with his own announcer?
Oh, yes. In fact, quite well known, a man named Danny Ray, who does the announcing. I'm not sure that was Danny there. I think that was a man named Fats Gonder, who is now dead. But yes, he travels with a man named Danny Ray, who's responsible for the capes and so forth.
Is this a James Brown innovation to have your own announcer traveling with you to introduce you?
Well, I think the innovation is for a performer to put together an entire review like that with an orchestra and so forth, and to take it around from city to city and to hold it together for more than 30 years. Some of America's greatest musicians have come to grief when they tried to put together what's in essence a big band, if you will, and try to make it work. But James was always able to do that. Yes, he was. That is an innovation in a kind of business, in a kind of show business way, and with the emphasis on business.
Would you describe James Brown's cape routine and how he created it?
Well, it comes at the end of the performance. Now he just simply more or less alludes to it in performance. But back when he was doing the days of Live at the Apollo and so forth, he would do a sort of collapse and resurrection routine at the end of the performance, because he would come out and knock himself out on stage for several hours dancing, singing, and so forth, and he was understandably exhausted. Of course, there's a good deal of histrionics involved, but he is genuinely exhausted. And in the beginning, one of the Famous Flames, the singers, would approach him, and they would put a raincoat around his shoulders and start to lead him off, and then he would shake it off like a boxer and come back out on the stage and go through the whole thing again, and until finally he would disappear. And then when the crowd had yelled long enough, he would appear again on stage dressed in a brand new suit and with a suitcase ready to hitchhike to the next town on the on the agenda. But after a while, as Bobby Bird, one of the famous Flames, told me, they started to lose their raincoats, so they decided to get a cape. Nobody wanted to volunteer their raincoat anymore. But he got the idea of using the cape, interestingly enough, from watching the famous wrestler of the 1950s, Gorgeous George, who used a cape and behaved in a similar fashion in the wrestling ring.
What about James Brown's hairdos? He used to have this really large process, and then in the late 60s got an afro, but his hair has always been a really important part of his style.
Yes, and getting that sort of modified afro in the 60s represented a painful concession for him, because he's always been very proud of his hair. In fact, if you look at the pictures in the book and you see the way in which his hair has evolved over the years, you get a kind of brief synopsis of cultural history right there.
My guest is Bruce Tucker, who collaborated with James Brown on Brown's autobiography, The Godfather of Soul. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bruce Tucker, who wrote with James Brown the book James Brown, The Godfather of Soul. And as you say, James Brown is really the godfather of funk. And the turning point for him in terms of starting to play funk was his 1965 record, Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. What was different about this record, and what did James Brown have to tell you about it?
Well, at this point, he didn't have to tell me anything about it, because it's been so influential. It's something that we now can hear very easily. But the difference in funk is that all of the rhythmic emphasis is on the one, is on that first downbeat at the beginning of a measure, and it really drives the music forward. You can hear it in this song in Embryo, and then in later work. Quite clearly. And the other thing is the polyrhythmic complexity, which is what James is known for. The other thing I think worth noting about this record is the date, 1965. If you recall, soul of both the shouting and the churchy varieties didn't peak until 67 or 68, and then more or less ended with the death of Dr. King. But in 1965, James was already leaving soul behind for funk. I mean, it's an amazingly revolutionary record if you put it in historical perspective like that.
I really like something he said to you about this record. He said that he discovered his strength wasn't in the horns, it was in the rhythm. He said he was hearing everything, even the guitars, like they were drums.
Exactly, yes. And I think that is the key to funk and the key to James Brown. Everything is used percussively, the voices, the guitars, the drums. He carried two and sometimes three drummers during this period on the road. Yes, everything is used percussively. I think one of the difficulties in making the case for musicians like James Brown for their importance is that Western music theory downgrades things that aren't important in European classical music, such as rhythm, and so there's no means of adequately notating it or so forth, or appreciating it, and so we're in a sense trained not to hear it, but it's there, and that's James's great, great achievement. Thank you.
the boomerang. Hey! Come on. Hey, hey! Come on.
James Brown is kind of a riddle to me politically. I mean, he had that really big and really influential record, Say It Loud and Black and I'm Proud, in 1968. He had supported H. Rapp Brown. At the same time, though, he supported Richard Nixon and played at Richard Nixon's inaugural. Can you help reconcile those two different political parts of James Brown?
Well, I think that it's difficult to reconcile the parts of James Brown, because I think James Brown is deeply ambivalent about a great many things, and I think it shows up in precisely those kinds of oppositions that you set up. He gave money to the H. Rapp Brown Defense Fund. He also bought a lifetime membership in the NAACP. He was a great admirer of Dr. Martin Luther King, and he's very close to Reverend Al Sharpton. He made a record that was almost contemporaneous with Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, called America Is My Home, for which he took a great deal of heat from a great many people. So I think that there's a deep contradiction in him, and I think it's difficult to reconcile. I think it's difficult for him to reconcile, because this country has greatly rewarded him and viciously punished him throughout his life, beginning from the time he was a child and right up to the present. So it's difficult to reconcile. The song "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud," which appeared in '68, of course, cost him his crossover audience. People became afraid to come to his concerts and so forth. And if you listen to the song, of course, what you immediately notice is that it's almost a children's song. There's a children's chorus on there singing the refrain.
Well, let's do what you just suggested a moment ago and listen to his 1968 record, Say It Loud. James Brown, recorded in 1968. One of the things James Brown talks about in the autobiography is how he hated disco and how he thinks he was really hurt by it.
Yes, unquestionably. In fact, he all but retired in the late 70s. All of these revolutionary records, you can hear and Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, in addition to being an anthem of black pride, it's also a really stripped-down, bare-bones, propulsive funk record, as funky as any record he ever made. All of that music that he made then in the late 60s and early 70s was suddenly obscured by disco. And it depressed him, and he all but retired from performing in this country. He still performed in Europe and Japan and so forth, but he semi-retired. He encountered a lot of personal problems at that time also. His second wife left him. The son, who was the apple of his eye, was killed in an automobile accident in upstate New York. And he retired for several years, in effect.
Did rap create a comeback for James Brown?
Well, actually, James's comeback in rap more or less coincided. I think what brought him back, and I think he would be the first to say this, is his appearance in the Blues Brothers, the motion picture, mm-hmm. in 1980, and then subsequently in one of the Rocky pictures, in which Living in America was included. But yes, rap has certainly brought him back. I think another thing that's been happening, and it's absolutely astonishing, is the critical reevaluation that has gone on of James Brown in the last 5 years. We've been talking today about how important he is as a musician. This is not merely my opinion. I think you would find that this is now the consensus among popular music critics, and it's an absolutely astonishing turnaround, because as recently as 1980 or the early 80s, the critics were relatively indifferent to him. But I think that that's explicable, because most people who write about popular music are middle-aged white men who don't dance.
Do you dance?
Yes, but I'm still a middle-aged white man.
Bruce Tucker collaborated with James Brown on his autobiography, James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. Our interview was recorded in 1990. We'll continue our James Brown birthday celebration on the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.